Okay.
I listened to it right after I got home because I'm like, Hazel, what did you think? I was in the shower. Yeah. What do you... What? No! Huh. It's like, what? You don't want me to clean? You're watching it right now. Huh. I'm like, just the choir part. You know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what I did. Directly to the... What is today? The
27.
327.
I thought it went to 26.
My
watch is
the 27.
A 27, okay.
Okay, hang on just a second here. I want to get everybody. I finally printed out.
You told me to. He said,
copy
hello.
Of this.
Okay.
Hello.
You cheated. Morning.
Okay, all right. Okay.
I'm Patty and me. And Jay. Some more coming this. And then Tom is online. Well, I'm glad somebody's online.
Although and Don, my granddaughters are here, so I couldn't swing the whole trip.
Oh, okay. Aww. Well, the only reason, I mean, of course, I'd rather have you here in person, but I'm glad somebody's online, because last week I brought my thing in, and I set the whole thing up, and nobody dialed in. I'm missing somebody. Wait a minute. Ruben. Oh, Glenn and Jamie. Okay, here we go. Okay, I think that's everybody. Yeah, I think so. Okay. So last week, you know, well, last week was rather hectic because of the because of the choir thing. So let me just kind of quickly summarize what we went over. I'm not going to read anything. I've taken out all my little tabs anyway. So, but last week we were talking about conversion. You know, there are, I guess you'd say, three more topics in Varieties of Religious Experience after we go over his general, well, first of all, his general definition of what religion is, and then the antitheses. Remember the optimistic versus pessimistic religion and the religion of the heart versus the religion of the head. After all that, there are three, you might say, miscellaneous topics. And so last week we talked about the first of those three, which is conversion. I thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, he started off by saying, well, there are three kinds of conversion. And you don't get the gist of it, I think, until you get to the end of the chapter, where he makes a big deal of the role of one's conscious life versus one's unconscious life in religion, and is arguing that in a lot of cases it's not just a lot of cases it's the unconscious self that is decisive in religious matters. Not always, but it certainly plays a very large role. And in the light of that, if you go back and look at his three types of conversion, you can see them as sort of on a continuum from a conscious sort of wrestling with various worldviews all the way to a unconscious overwhelming of the conscious self. In other words, the three types of conversion were, remember, the first one he said was kind of like Augustine, because Augustine in his Confessions, you know, it's largely, or at least the first nine books, is an account of his conversion. Account of his life, but culminating in his conversion. And he was absolutely aware of all the issues. I mean, you know, there was he has this picture of what it takes to be a Christian, and he has this picture of what he is now. And of course, he's an intellectual anyway, and so obviously this was all the stuff that he was, you know, going over and over and over in his conscious mind. And when he finally took the plunge and converted to Christianity, it was very much a conscious decision. I mean, it wasn't anything welling up from the depths or anything like that. It was pretty much a conscious decision. Okay, I was here. I really wanted to be here. I couldn't quite summon the willpower to do it, but now I've got it. So now I'm here, and I was here, and I'm not going back. That's the gist of it. So that's conversion type number one. The second one is when the alternate worldview, as James says, is on the periphery. So unlike the first one, where the two are right there, front and center, and you're weighing them or struggling or whatever, but consciously so. And the second type of conversion, the alternate ego, as it were, is on the periphery of consciousness. So it's on the, you know, it's kind of on the borderline between consciousness and unconsciousness. And James characterizes it by saying, well, then conversion on that model is what was on the periphery becomes central, and what was central goes to the periphery, or so, or maybe your focus, maybe that stays, you know, your focus, whatever model you like to think of, however you like to think of it, but at any rate, at some point, what had been on the periphery becomes the focus, and then what was the focus now is shunted aside to the periphery. So that in that case, it's the periphery, so it's not unconscious per se, but it's not in the forefront of your mind. I mean, that's what we mean by saying it's on the periphery, right? It's, you're not thinking about it like Augustine was weighing the two in a whole deal. It's more like out there, and, you know, if I thought about it, I could bring it to mind. But I just usually don't even focus on it. So it's, and that makes some sense. I can understand how something that could have been on the periphery at some point becomes, you know, central to somebody. Now, I haven't sat back and thought about trying to come up with an example. I'd have to. Can anybody think of an example of that off the top of their head? I mean, it's one thing to describe in the abstract.
Does James have an example?
I don't remember. Probably does. I just don't remember. He cites a lot of literature and a lot of, you know, I think there was probably more interest at that time in these sort of, there's a lot of sort of psychical research going on, you know, and you know, mediumship telepathy and stuff like that. So he may very well cite one of those. I just don't remember.
This was when Sigmund Freud was coming.
True. Yeah, I know. That's there's a lot of interplay there, I think. Well, anyway, the third type though is all the way into the unconscious, and that is when, I can I can certainly see, it's when some sort of traumatic event occurs in your life, and it's so traumatic that, as it were, the brain completely just reorganizes itself, so to speak, and what had been just not even on the periphery, but just maybe deep in the subconscious, all of a sudden it volcanically comes up and supplants the former structure. I said at the time, I said last week, it reminds me of Thomas S. Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that Kuhn says, well, he's talking about science, of course, but he says, you know, there are years and years of normal science, and anomalies are always found, but people usually don't pay that much attention to them. But eventually the anomalies accumulate, the whole business comes crashing down, you have this period of chaos, and then a new paradigm takes over, and then you have years and years and years of normal science again, until that one comes crashing, you know, that kind of thing. Well, it also reminds me of Julian Jaynes. And I taught this several years ago, this weird theory that Jaynes had, and it's developed into like a cult, honestly. But he published this book back in the 80s, maybe? I don't know. It's a good long time ago now. Called The Origins of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, where he argued that until about 1000 BCE, people literally were not conscious. And it's a wild theory. And because of the end of the Bronze Age, there was a lot of just disruption in the Eastern Mediterranean, a lot of shifting of populations, and a lot of you know, a lot of things became unstable all of a sudden. And James was arguing, well, because of that, and the brain being a very malleable organ anyway, it caused a mass reorganization in the brain. But one of the side effects of this reorganization was the origin of consciousness. Well, anyway, well, this has become a cult. I kid you not.
The Chinese how?
Well, you know, there's something called the Julian Jane Society, and I joined it because I had a question. I just wanted to ask a very simple question about. It was just a would have been a difficulty and. And so, in order to be able to ask the question, I had to join the Julia Jane Society to post my question, which I did, and I got a kind of an unsatisfactory answer. But anyway, but now I always get these notifications.
Yep.
You know what I mean, right?
Yep.
So, if, for example, a movie or a book or anything mentions the name Julian Jaynes, I'll get a notification from the society that, oh, check out this movie, you know. So I'm sure he's dead now, but he's got this loyal following of almost religious following. But anyway, that's what that reminded me of, too. It reminded me of Jane's idea that the, you know, the brain can be constructed in a lot of different ways, and a traumatic experience can indeed cause a complete paradigm shift. Yeah.
Would this be kind of like, you know, the destruction of the Second Temple and how that kind of gave rise to Christianity?
Well,
in some ways, or spurred it along? But that's more
indeed,
on a population basis rather
indeed.
Than...
Indeed. Or you could say the destruction of the First Temple, too. Mm-hmm. If you recognize, as I think is in fact true, although it's not orthodox, but... a lot of people contend that the Hebrews were not really monotheistic prior to the Babylonian exile. They were monolatrous. In other words, they worshipped only one God. But that doesn't mean that they didn't think there were other gods out there. And I always explained that, well, once they, during the Babylonian exile, you know, either you were going to have to give up your religion altogether or rethink it. But you could also kind of take it like James is saying, you know, like getting hit over the head. You know, the temple gets destroyed. I mean, that's a traumatic development right there. And, you know, you could say, well, that precipitated a reorganization, as it were, and a complete sort of revolution within the Jewish or the Hebrew culture. And the same thing, the Second Temple, too. Yeah, I could see that, you know, depending on how central that is to your whole belief system. I can see that in both cases. That's a good point.
Think it, James is thinking more in terms of what happened to a person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
you
true.
You know, traumatic effect, like losing your loved one.
Yeah.
You know, that suddenly you realize, oh, come on, life is so short.
Yeah.
We have to reorganize our
mm-hmm.
priorities.
Yeah. You're right.
A lot of time left. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he is talking about individuals,
yeah.
of course. But, you know, you could apply the theory to groups as well, I think. But anyway, the three kinds of conversion then do indeed sort of form a continuum between consciousness and unconsciousness. Because that third one is completely just nowhere in view. And all of a sudden it becomes right. You know, just the main structure that comes about. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. The three kinds of sort of conversion seen in the light of his later distinction between conscious and unconscious influences on religious belief. The next topic that we're going to talk about today is the lecture or lecturers. I forget how many lectures. Some of these are grouped together, and I don't know if this is one or more than one lecture. It's titled Saintliness. Actually, it's three lectures that he grouped together. So this is a study of saintliness, another kind of miscellaneous topic, I guess, but a topic of interest if you're writing a book or giving a series of talks on the varieties of religious experience, because that is part of it, too. So let's hear what he has to say about saintliness. And the first thing he does is to try to sort of define it, or at least state its necessary conditions. So let me read what he has to say. The collective name for the ripe fruits of religion in a character is saintliness. The saintly character is the character for which spiritual emotions are the habitual center of the personal energy. And there's a certain composite photograph of universal saintliness, the same in all religions, of which the features can easily be traced. There are three. Or they are these. Sorry, these. I think actually there are four. Well, there are four that start off, and then he has three more. So, number one, a feeling of being in a wider life than that of this world's selfish little interests, and a conviction, not merely intellectual, but as it were sensible, of the existence of an ideal power. In Christian saintliness, this power is always personified as God, but abstract moral ideals, civic or patriotic utopias, or inner visions of holiness or right may also be felt as the true lords and enlargers of our life in ways which I described in the lecture on the reality of the unseen. And this kind of comes up with something we talked about earlier when I said, well, back in the heyday of communism, was that a religion? Remember, we were talking about religion. He does add, right? He does add. They're not just theistic ideals, but also civic or patriotic utopias and that sort of thing. So anyway, some sort of conviction then in a higher entity of some sort, be it God or a utopia or whatever. Number two, a sense of the friendly continuity of the ideal power with our own life and a willing self-surrender to its control. That's number two. Number three, an immense elation and freedom as the outlines of the confining selfhood melt down. So you feel yourself sort of identified with God or this utopia or whatever it is, and so your own personal concerns become melted away, as it were. And number four, a shifting of the emotional center towards loving and harmonious affections, towards yes, yes, and away from no, where the claims of the non-ego are concerned. So that's kind of like three, this breakdown of your own individual separation from this ideal power and your willingness to be completely at its mercy, so to speak. My whole life now is devoted to whatever relationship I have to this power. Then there are three more characteristics. There's seven altogether, but those are the essential ones. But then he thinks there are sort of three, I don't know, less central ones. These fundamental interconditions have characteristic practical consequences. So these are the practical consequences, as he puts it, practical consequences, as follows. Number one, asceticism. The self-surrender may become so passionate as to turn into self-immolation. It may then so overrule the ordinary inhibitions of the flesh that the saint finds positive pleasure in sacrifice and asceticism, measuring and expressing as they do the degree of his loyalty to the higher power. So you may be so invested in this higher power that you so invested in your complete subservience to the higher power that you voluntarily, deny yourself whatever. I just had finished in my one of my Ollie classes. I'm doing Hegel, and I had just finished talking about the unhappy consciousness, which is Hegel's word for the Middle Ages, or at least one aspect of the Middle Ages. And what he's talking about is exactly this kind of thing. This denying of yourself and everything that makes life meaningful, really, right, in the service of a higher power. And for Hegel, that's not a good thing. That's an unhappy consciousness, right. And I think he's right. But anyway, yes, asceticism is frequently connected with this saintliness. Number two, strength of soul. The sense of enlargement of life may be so uplifting that personal motives and inhibitions, commonly omnipotent, become too insignificant for notice, and new reaches of patience and fortitude open out. This is kind of like the other, but not exactly. Fears and anxieties go, and blissful equanimity takes their place. Come heaven, come hell, it makes no difference now. So this, along with this ascetic sort of life, there's this feeling of, well, everything is
that's
fine.
Yeah.
Purity is number three. The shifting of the emotional center brings with it, first, increase of purity. The sensitiveness to spiritual discords is enhanced, and the cleansing of existence from brutal and sensual elements becomes imperative. Occasions of contact with such elements are avoided. The saintly life must deepen its spiritual consistency and keep unspotted from the world. You know, well, we got to go to a, you know, get thee to a nunnery type thing. You got to get to a monastery, or maybe live all by yourself, or what have you. Let's see. In some temperaments, this need of purity of spirit takes an ascetic turn, weaknesses of the flesh are treated with relentless severity. Okay. And four, charity. The shifting of the emotional center brings, secondly, increase of charity, tenderness for fellow creatures. The ordinary motives to antipathy, which usually set such close bounds to tenderness among human beings, are inhibited. The saint loves his enemies and treats loathsome beggars as his brothers. So anyway, there you go. That's his take then on the what the saintly life is like. Now, the way he's thinking of this too, he connects the saints with being maybe in some cases founders of new religions, or possibly maybe renewers of a religion, something like that. But in other words, what he's interested in, of course, being a pragmatist, this is why he's interested in, he's interested in the practical effects of saintliness, right? This is not just a matter of somebody doing something for one's own benefit, but this saint, this saintly person, is going to have some sort of effects, at least the most saintly ones, on the society around them, and that's kind of what he's interested in. One interesting thing about James, I think, just as an aside, and you can see it in what I just read, is his constant, this is more implied here but expressed explicitly elsewhere, you know, for James, religion is a matter of the heart, right? And not so much a matter of the head, even though our last topic, which we'll get to, is more James as theologian, and you know, what does he really think in terms of the head? But over and over and over and over again, you have in here, and that's why I think James is a lot like Kierkegaard. Except he's not as much in your face as Kierkegaard was, but I mean, you know, Kierkegaard is basically, you know, saying, I don't care about the objections that you may raise to the existence of God. I don't care about the problem of evil or any of these things. I could care less. I'm just decided to believe no matter what. This leap of faith, or even better, a leap of faith in the face of all reasons to the contrary. Well, anyway, James is a little like that, not as much, though. But anyway. So, that's what I said a minute ago, though, about the practical effects, that's where he goes next. Let's see, the original factor in fixing the figure of the gods must always have been psychological. The deity to whom the prophets, seers, and devotees who founded the particular cult bore witness to was worth something to them personally. Okay? So once again, he's thinking of the saints in terms of their large effects on maybe founding a religion or reforming a religion or something like, or I guess it would include too some of the Catholic founders of orders, you know, St. Francis of Assisi, for example, you know, that sort of thing.
Don, may I ask something here?
Yeah.
In the earlier discussion, those terms, those phrases did not sound like they were a huge bar to get over. You know, you might say your grandmother was saintly.
Oh.
This next section of being found of an order, that would imply that he thinks it's very rare.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, if I said my sainted grandmother, he would say, you're using the word saint in a different sense.
Right.
Actually, I can think of three senses that one could distinguish. There's his sense.
You know, if I look at those phrases, right? You know, I mean, a lot of people could maybe be described by those four points earlier.
You're breaking up, but I think I get the gist of your question. No, I don't think so. I think he means this in a very rigorous fashion. I mean, when he says asceticism, he doesn't mean somebody who just, you know, like a Catholic who would eat fish on Fridays or something like that. You know, he means all out and out asceticism in this charity business. Well, it's not that I give a little bit of money to the Salvation Army at Christmas time.
You go everything.
Yeah, you go out and you seek out the homeless, mm-hmm. or what have you. So these are big deals. So it wouldn't describe just your ordinary decent person. But I was going to say, I can imagine as you were talking, three senses of the word saint. There's James's sense, which is really a very, very extreme case. Whether you like it or not, it's very extreme. Secondly, we use the word saint, I think, much more often in a very loose sense to mean somebody who is admirable.
Good.
Yeah, a good person. The kind of person who gives the Salvation Army at Christmas time, not going all the way to, you know, palling around with homeless people or what have you. But I think more commonly in our American uses, we use the word saint in that way. You know, so and so was such a saint, or is such a saint, you know. Thirdly, there's the sort of technical theological usage when we sing for all the saints on All Saints Sunday.
Yeah.
That means those who have died and are in heaven, right? That's what that means. Or when the saints go marching in, you know, that kind of thing. They have died, they're in heaven. That's a technical theological use. So we have three uses of the word saint, but I'm saying that to clarify the point in answer to Tom's question. So the way James is using the word saint is number one. I think the way you were using the word saint, Tom, was number two. So these prophets, seers, and devotees who founded the particular cult the deity to whom you do need a subject, don't you? The deity to whom the prophets, seers, and devotees who founded the particular cult bore witness. The deity, to whom they bore witness, was worth something to them personally. They could use him. He guided their imagination, warranted their hopes, and controlled their will. Or else they required him as a safeguard against the demon and the curber of other people's crimes. In any case, they chose him for the value of the fruits he seemed to them to yield. Mm-hmm. So in other words, this is the pragmatist talking here. Why do saints choose the particular ideal that they do choose? Well, it's because of the fruits that ideal to them is likely to yield, says James.
Promises.
Yeah, they're going to have some sort of beneficial, practical result, right? So soon as the fruits begin to seem quite worthless, so soon as they conflicted with indispensable human ideals or thwarted too extensively other values, so soon as they appeared childish or contemptible or immoral when reflected on the deity grew discredited and was ere long neglected and forgotten. So these saints aren't going to be saints unless the ideal to which they subscribe is something that's going to have some sort of beneficial effect. So, for example, imagine a committed communist, going back to that, you know, this political utopia or social utopia, committed communist, 1989 rolls around, or whatever it was, the Soviet Union broke up. That was 89 was the Berlin Wall. But anyway, but 91 or something like that, whatever it was, you know. Well, anyway, everything goes crashing down. And this committed communist has started having second thoughts, you know. Well, maybe this utopian ideal wasn't quite so utopian after all. Mm-hmm. Maybe the effects of it are not as beneficial as I thought at the time, mm-hmm. and now becomes a different person, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Well, anyway, how about us? How about us philosophers, or I should say us pragmatists? How about us? You know, how are we going to evaluate these saints? Well, guess what? Pragmatically, right? The gods we stand by are the gods we need and can use. The gods whose demands on us are reinforcements of our demands on ourselves and on one another. What I then propose to do is, briefly stated, to test saintliness by common sense, of course. This is James all through and through. To use human standards to help us decide how far the religious life commends itself as an ideal kind of human activity. If it commends itself, then any theological beliefs that may inspire it, insofar forth, will stand accredited. If not, then they will be discredited, and all without reference to anything but human working principles. So I, he says, as a psychologist slash philosopher, but most importantly as a pragmatist, I'm going to evaluate these saintly lives in terms of their fruits, in terms of their beneficial results, or possibly harmful results, right? And to the extent that the results are beneficial, that will lend some credence to the theological substructure on which those actions are based. In other words, if, say, a Christian is living a life that is just so overwhelmingly admirable and that has so many beneficial practical results, then I'm more inclined to take seriously the theological basis for that person's actions, right? That makes some, I mean, it's vaguely, but a lot of things in James are vague, vaguely similar to the scientific procedure, right? As a scientist, I propose a theory. You know? And the question is, well, okay, is the theory true or not? Well, what do I do if I'm a scientist, and the pragmatist would buy into this, he would say, well, I look at its practical results. You know, this theory, Einstein says that light will be affected by mass. And so an extremely massive object, such as the sun, should actually noticeably, I mean, any object, but I mean, usually it's too small to be detectable, but something like the sun is, you know, fairly big. So, I mean, it will bend light in a noticeable way. Therefore, my theory predicts that in an eclipse of the sun, a star, which should be behind the sun, we can calculate precisely where it's located and the sun is in the way of it, should be visible. Why? Because the light coming from the star will, it's going up this way, but here's the sun, and it gets bent, and we see it even though it's behind the sun. So in other words, that's my theory, and if in fact the practical effects, i.e. what I observe, pan out, why, that helps confirm the theory, right? That's the idea. Well, and James is saying, well, look, I mean, I know it's not a rigorous similarity, but still it's somewhat similar. Some saintly person is acting in the world on the basis of a theological theory, so to speak, and those actions are like, or our evaluation of those actions is like our observing the sun in an eclipse to see if we see that star behind it, right? And if in fact we assess that person's actions in a positive light and are really, really impressed by what that person can accomplish. Well, that serves to confirm the theory, i.e. the theological theory, in the same way that our observation of that star confirms Einstein's theory. You see what I mean? It's an analogy. Obviously, it's not as rigorous in the case of the saintly behavior as in the case of the scientific experiment, but it's somewhat similar. You know, and mutatis mutandis on the other side, if I don't see the star, that's a real problem for the theory. And similarly, if this person's actions, this supposed saint, don't bear fruit and are not somehow beneficial to society or whatever, then that helps to undercut the theological theory. See what I mean?
Yeah.
See what I mean? So it's very, very similar. So as pragmatists, we need to look at it that way, he's saying. It's kind of interesting, actually.
So Don, he must have been impressed with the Catholic rule that you had to have certified miracles.
Yeah, could be. I mean, that's kind of similar, because miracles hopefully are good things, hopefully. Yeah, it is kind of similar. But, I mean, he has a much broader, as is usual for James,
right,
a much broader and vaguer sort of test here. See, where was I? Yeah, that was really neat. So then he goes on. It is but the elimination of the humanly unfit and the survival of the humanly fittest applied to religious beliefs. And if we look at history candidly and without prejudice, we have to admit that no religion has ever, in the long run, established or proved itself in any other way. A religion's not going to work unless it works. Right? It's not going to be around very long if it doesn't have some sort of beneficial results, because people aren't stupid. Hopefully. I always when I tell people the classical definition of human as rational animal, I kind of keep my fingers crossed or knock on wood when I say the word rational. Well, anyway, religions have approved themselves. They have ministered to sundry vital needs which they found reigning. When they violated other needs too strongly, or when other faiths came which served the same needs better, the first religions were supplanted. And then he has a little quick sort of generic history of religious revolutions, as it were. And this is what he says, and this strikes me as being accurate, I think. A genuine first-hand religious experience is bound to be a heterodoxy to its witnesses. So the original, this new saint that's come into town and is preaching something that's eventually going to be maybe a reformation within the religion, or maybe even a new religion or something, but it's going to have some significant effect. What's the first reaction of people? This is heresy. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the first reaction. So a first-hand religious experience is bound to be heterodoxy to his witnesses. The prophet appearing as a mere lonely madman. And if his doctrine proved contagious enough to spread to any others, it becomes a definite and labeled heresy. But if it then still proved contagious enough to triumph over persecution, it becomes itself an orthodoxy. And when a religion has become an orthodoxy, its day of inwardness is over. The spring is dry, the faithful live at second hand exclusively, and stone the prophets in their turn. So we have a new orthodoxy, and God forbid that I should ever deviate from that. So some new saint comes along who can improve things, but guess what? The first reaction is, well, you're a heretic. Stone him to death. That was a line from, was it a line from St. Paul? Were you here when we did St. Paul? Probably not. We did that under Connie. And also Elijah. Well, you know, it's like singing D.A.C. Right. It's always so much fun to do these angry. And so in both of them, I think there's a crowd scene where the choir is the angry crowd. And I think it was in St. Paul, and one of the choral pieces is "Stone him to death." Stone him to death. It's great fun to sing. Well, anyway, so yeah, that's what we do to new heterodoxies, right? Because now we are ossified in our own orthodoxy. The new church, in spite of whatever human goodness it may foster, can henceforth counted on as a staunch ally in every attempt to stifle the spontaneous religious spirit and to stop all later bubblings of the fountain from which, in pure days, it drew its own supply of inspiration. See, as a little footnote at the bottom, almost, piety is the mask; the inner force is tribal instinct. Well, anyway. So yeah, that's your typical sequence of events when saints come marching in. You know, they have these really striking lives that seem to be so extraordinary, and they seem to be able to do things that ordinary people muster the fortitude to act in ways that an ordinary person just cannot do. And then we sit back and we say, okay, is this beneficial or not? You know, I mean, that's just the human tendency. We're all pragmatists, so says William James. Anyway, we sit back and we see, with a critical eye, to see if this is going to have beneficial effects or not. And if it does, it will start gaining adherence, and eventually it'll overthrow the old orthodoxy and then become just as intolerant as its predecessor. That's the sort of typical sequence of events. So, any comments, questions, or anything? We have like 2 minutes, and I'm not going to start a whole new theme with 2 minutes left. What's happened to Bonnie? Somebody tell me where Bonnie is. I haven't seen her for 3 weeks. Anybody know? And also, Lauren, what's her name? Marty's friend? Erica. No, Erica. Was Erica the one? Erica Walker, I think.
No, it's Tammy's sister.
Huh?
That's Tammy's sister, Erica Walker.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, then that's not who I'm thinking about then. I forget. I have to go back and look at the other one. It's okay.
Well, Don, that last part did sound like Thomas Kuhn.
Yeah, that part too, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, an overthrow of a paradigm and replacing by it with a new paradigm. Yeah.
So, but that definition implies you can't be a saint if you're just doing tremendous things or the equivalent of miracles. You must change the paradigm.
It does. I mean, yeah, yeah, or to some extent, yes. I think that's true because, of course, James is a pragmatist. Right? What else would you expect a pragmatist to say? You know,
but miracles are very pragmatic. I mean, assuming you believed in them versus a revolution.
Yeah, but somebody who went around healing the sick right and left is going to probably wind up with a lot of adherence. Right? So, I mean, it will have practical effects. I mean, for that matter, just healing the sick is a practical effect right then and there.
But it could be done in the context of the existing religion.
Yeah, although you might say it could be a minor reformation within maybe a small segment of that religion.
Formation of an order. And
yeah, yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, like St. Francis would be a good example of that. Yeah. And he didn't overthrow the entire Catholic Church, but, you know, there was a movement there. And it was a good thing.
Well, yeah, like people who would say Mother Teresa was saintly, she wouldn't really qualify.
I was thinking
maybe not. I mean, maybe the jury's still out on that one. Whether she qualifies in a Jamesian sense, in other words.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, not the Catholic sense.
I know. Yeah. True. But I know. But once again, that's the second. I would say the American use of the word of saintly, mm-hmm. somebody who's just really, really good. You know, that kind of thing. Maybe. Yeah. Well, anyway, the remaining topic, well, you know what? The remaining topic is the title of the chapter, the last chapter, well, the second to last chapter, actually, is Other Characteristics, is the title of it. Not very informative. And then the final chapter is titled Conclusion. but both of them kind of go together, and here's where James's, what I'm calling James's Neoplatonism comes out. So we will conclude next week with James's Neoplatonism from the variety of religious experience, and then the last work of James we're going to cover is the A Pluralistic Universe, which will continue the same theme, that so-called Neoplatonism, and then we'll be done with William James. So what's today again, the 27th? Mm-hmm. So this is the last Sunday in March, and so we'll have one or two more Sundays on James, and then I'll move on to Wittgenstein. That's my plan. So
thank you.
See ya.
Great. Hey, Patty, did you, did Don tell you about